Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, September 14th, 2013. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. This has been a most extraordinary week. When it began, it seemed as though a military strike against Syria was inevitable, as the president was blustering and flustering and sounding as bellicose as he could. But a series of developments took place, none of them which were really predictable. And we have at least had a postponement of a U.S. attack, but things are continuing to move very, very quickly. While we're not out of the woods yet, as the forces pushing for U.S. military intervention in Syria still intend to launch a war, and as long as the unstable puppet Obama remains in the White House, we cannot be sure that he might not resort to some flight forward action out of rage or frustration, which could lead to World War III. But for the moment, what is clear is that there is an outline of a new strategic and political geometry coming into being, which includes, among other things, a bigger role played by President Putin and Russia, and awakening in the Congress, which is largely fueled by response, and I mean very significant response, in the American people, where we were seeing calls in the Congress almost 100-1 against a U.S. intervention in Syria. And it's also propelled by a vision for the future, promoted by Lyndon LaRouche and LaRouche PAC, which is a post-Obama, post-imperial future centered around the elimination of Wall Street and a return to real physical science and new technologies. Joining me on the program today to discuss these rapid changes and what must be done to assure we can enter into this new era is Jeffrey Steinberg. Jeff is an editor of the EIR and a leading strategic analyst who's played a very significant behind-the-scenes and in some cases in front-of-the-scenes role in shaping this new geometry in Washington. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Harley. How you doing?
Good. Well, let's begin with the latest developments, which include an announcement this morning that Secretary of State Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov reached an agreement on how to proceed with dealing with the question of Syria's chemical weapons, which goes much beyond chemical weapons. So where does this stand?
Well, after three very intensive days of back-and-forth meetings in which teams of experts in chemical warfare, Brahimi, the special U.S. UN envoy, Kofi Annan, who was Brahimi's predecessor, all were gathered there in Geneva. An agreement was reached well into the night last night between John Kerry and Sergei Lavrov, and then the technical people spent the next 4 or 5 hours working through a final draft, which was signed this morning by Kerry and Lavrov. The basic outlines of the deal are that, number one, within the next week, Syria will provide a complete inventory of their entire chemical weapons program, stockpiles, production capabilities, all of that, and that the United Nations will come in at that point and will oversee the dismantling of that chemical weapons program. The UN inspectors are to be on the ground in Syria by sometime early November, and the whole process is to be completed by middle of 2014. This is a very ambitious timetable, but is something that is both doable and, number one, means that military strikes, for the moment at least, are off the table. Number two, it lays the foundations for reviving in a much more credible basis the push for the Geneva II conference that's been kicking around for almost a year and a half, which would involve representatives of the Syrian government and the rebels and coming up with some kind of a grand bargain civil war.
On this second point, though, it seems as though the most outspoken opponent of any kind of an agreement between Kerry and Lavrov are these so-called rebels, that they've said repeatedly they don't want to go to Geneva, they don't trust this kind of agreement. Was there anything in the negotiations that would include the U.S. using its influence to shift the position of the rebels? Because aren't we also beginning the shipments of arms to them?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of that kind of thing that's been being discussed behind the scenes. I mean, quite frankly, the rebels look like a bunch of fools, because here they were screaming and yelling that the U.S. had to bomb Syria back to the Stone Age on the basis of these chemical weapons. And now the U.S. and Russia have come together and struck a deal with the Syrians to abolish those chemical weapons, and the rebels don't want to go along with it? I mean, you know, at a certain point, their behavior defies logic. And, of course, in reality, what we're dealing with are a number of other international players, Saudi Arabia obviously being one critical one, Kuwait, Qatar, Turkey, Britain, France. A lot of people have a stake in this effort to get the United States to carry out military strikes against the Assad government. So
the countries you just named, then, we could assume would be opposed to or unhappy with any agreement of this sort.
Right, and the question is, are they going to be unhappy and sulk on the sidelines, or are the British, the Saudis, and others going to try to take some kind of action to sabotage the process before it gets locked in? Right now, the momentum is in the direction of the Putin initiative, which has been accepted by President Obama and by Kerry. I think it's crucial, though, to go back and see how this dynamic played out over the last 3 weeks, because 3 weeks ago, President Obama made a firm decision that he was going to order military strikes and that he was going to do this without going to Congress and without going to the UN Security Council. Now, this was all happening while Congress was still in recess and members of Congress were back in their home districts. Across the board, Congress was reporting that calls were running basically 100-1 against military action. The American people were fed up with more than a decade of wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Congress had basically abandoned its constitutional responsibilities in the Libya case and let the president go to war without any congressional approval. And that war went way beyond 60 days under the War Powers Resolution. Obama was not impeached. Congress was further discredited. But if you go back to the late spring, a series of scandals began to surface in the media, starting with the whole issue of what really did happen in Benghazi.
Right.
Was the U.S. under Obama covertly running a kind of a replay of Iran-Contra, running weapons to the Syrian rebels out of Benghazi? Was that why there were 35 CIA agents operating out of that annex? Then you had the sequence of scandals, the IRS enemies list, an Obama enemies list, hearkening back to Nixon. Then you had two revelations about spying on the media, Associated Press and Fox. And then the big one was the revelations about the mass NSA spying that came out from Edward Snowden. This kicked Congress in the ass because the American people were absolutely furious and were holding Congress accountable for letting all of this happen without doing any oversight.
So it's not just war weariness, but a rejection of the whole political process, but also, I think, a complete dissatisfaction with the president.
Right, and you know, the underlying issues have been the fact that for the average American, the economic conditions have worsened and worsened. There's been no recovery since September 2008, meaning that we've had 4.5 years of Obama in office, and it's been a downward slide throughout that period. So it's an accumulative picture of frustrations welling over. So suddenly, here's Obama literally issuing orders, having targets selected, telling top advisors in the cabinet in the White House that he's going to order military strikes without congressional approval and without the Security Council. And at the last minute, the overwhelming opposition in the country forced him to blink. And so he said, I'll go to Congress, but with the backing of Boehner and Pelosi and Reid and McConnell, we'll be able to ram it through Congress. And then, even though I will not have the United Nations Security Council approval, I'll have at least satisfied the constitutional obligations of going to Congress.
Jeff, you mentioned the reaction from the population and also the Congress. I assume there was also a factor here involving the U.S. military, particularly General Dempsey, who did not exhibit any great relish to launch strikes.
They were adamantly opposed from the beginning, and at a certain point, however, the role of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs is as the principal military advisor to the president. As a decision is being made, he weighs in at the table as a very important voice, and he voiced strong opposition. But once the president said, I've made up my mind, we're going for military action, give me the best set of targets based on what we want to accomplish, from that point on, Dempsey's responsibilities shifted. And so he's been notably quiet, whereas a number of retired generals, Barry McCaffrey, Tony Zinni, General Scales, have all come out basically saying, don't do it. And the most dramatic intervention of all was made by Lyndon LaRouche, who basically put out a 7-point statement in which he said that the danger of this serious situation getting out of control should the U.S. launch a single missile strike, and the danger of this getting all the way up to the level of a superpower confrontation in which thermonuclear weapons are used, is so great that all other considerations have to be set aside because nobody wants to start a war of annihilation, and Syria could be the trigger for exactly that kind of war.
Jeff, among the other things then that intervened, obviously I don't think anybody expected that the British Parliament would prevent Cameron from going ahead as the U.S.'s trusted ally. That had to be a blow also to Obama.
That was Thursday, 2 days before Obama announced he was changing his mind and going to Congress. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So what happened at that point is that once they began to try to put in place a majority vote in both houses of Congress, they very soon realized that they didn't have it. So in other words, Congress has been responsive to the fact that the population, the governed, have not given their consent for this war.
Jeff, you spend a lot of time speaking to people on the Hill. This really did take off in a way that, again, couldn't have been predicted because I think most people thought that the Senate was a slam dunk for Obama and that with Pelosi and especially Eric Cantor and Boehner on his side, that he'd be able to marshal the vote. But it really slipped away very quickly. What was your sense from what was going on in the Hill, how that thing worked?
They never had it. They were deluding themselves. Boehner and Eric Cantor thought that they'd be able to deliver the Republicans, who are traditionally the war party, but they didn't have the support of many of the leading voices of the Republican Party establishment. When you get Newt Gingrich coming out as a staunch anti-war Republican, you've got trouble. So they miscalculated, the White House miscalculated. By Monday, the day before Obama was to deliver his war speech before the American people, the number crunchers at the White House told the president that there were 148 definite no votes in the House, only 25 definite yes votes, and most of the undecideds were swinging in the direction of no. So they lost, and had Obama gone ahead with the push for war, had they gone for the vote in the Congress and lost, then the Obama presidency would have been finished. LaRouche has been saying for weeks that the guy is going down. He's more unpopular, has a lower approval rating at this point than George Bush did after Katrina, which, by the way, occurred in August of the first year of his second term. So we're in that same cycle with Obama, and his numbers are polling 5-10 points below that of George Bush after Katrina destroyed his presidency.
I think you can see also in his mannerisms and his sputtering and his shifting that he is lost. He doesn't seem to know what to do. And, you know, this idea that he somehow deftly managed to pull a diplomatic coup, which is what some people are trying to portray, is really a fraud.
Well, what happened is that when he was in St. Petersburg and had his private meeting on the sidelines with President Putin, Putin put an offer on the table that was the best offer that Obama had, which was we can get the Syrian government to agree to sign the Chemicals Weapons Convention and dismantle their chemical weapons arsenal. That means that you don't order military strikes. The situation goes back, reverts back to the United Nations where it belongs in the first place. But you and I look like the guys who jointly avoided war.
But was that rejected by Obama after the St. Petersburg talks, or did he just keep that in mind?
No, it was on the table, and okay. The whole idea that on Monday in London, Kerry made some kind of, you know, offhanded cynical comment and that got the ball rolling is just absolutely untrue. It was discussed in St. Petersburg. It was an option that was the only option that was available to Obama. He had lost the American people. He had lost the Congress. Were he to go ahead with a unilateral military action without getting Congress to vote first, there were articles of impeachment already drawn up that were ready to go. So, in a certain sense, all great military commanders who know that the real objective is winning the peace, defeating the enemy by winning the peace, know that you always give the enemy a way out. If they're absolutely boxed into a corner and have no way out, the response is unpredictable. And in this case, the danger of thermonuclear war looms very large in the background. So Putin very wisely offered Obama an exit strategy, and it was the only door available. Now, that says two things. It says, number one, that you have the potential for a genuine reset of the U.S.-Russian relationship. But it also says that Obama came to this table with great reluctance. And there are many people who are furious at what Putin was able to accomplish and what came out of the Lavrov-Kerry detailed diplomatic work. The British are hysterical. The French are hysterical. Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar, UAE, they're all miserable. The people who Obama was negotiating with, including John McCain, Lindsey Graham, who got Obama to promise a much bigger bombing campaign, are furious at the fact that the situation is now gone back into a diplomacy mode, and where suddenly there's new life breathed into the Geneva II process. But I think that I was in a discussion late this morning with Mr. LaRouche, and his view was that the implications of this shift go far, far beyond the immediates of the Syria situation.
I think that's really important to get to. I just want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Jeffrey Steinberg. It's Saturday, September 20th. I'm sorry, September 14th. I'm jumping ahead of myself here. And we're discussing the extraordinary shifts in the strategic situation and the potential that opens. And, you know, Jeff, on the one side, you talk about these potentials. There's still the problem that Obama's in the White House. And this does raise the question of what can be done to move this situation, to build on this momentum. And you were just talking about what Mr. LaRouche said this morning. Why don't you pick up on that?
Well, you've had a certain directionality that goes back to January of 2001, right at the point that George W. Bush and Dick Cheney came into office. Ever since that moment, the United States has been in an accelerating downward trajectory. The Constitution has been ripped up. The economy has been looted to the point of destruction. For the first time in American history, we went to war at the same time that the government gave massive tax breaks to the wealthiest citizens. The United States has been bankrupted through a succession of policies that carried through two terms of Bush and Cheney that were continued and, in fact, accelerated in many respects during the first 4.5 years of Obama. And now, with this agreement, there's the potential for a break, for a change in fundamental direction. And this is where it's time for big ideas to be put on the table and implemented. Now, obviously, one immediate and crucial issue is that we must have Glass-Steagall here in the United States, in Europe, because Glass-Steagall is the first step towards a kind of new Bretton Woods global arrangement that establishes global credit for a major leap into the future. The basement team under Mr. LaRouche's direction has produced a 56-page report called Nuclear NAWAPA 21, which goes through a perspective of a genuine trans-Pacific development program. For that program to be fully realized, we've got to put the investment into a crash effort to finally achieve thermonuclear fusion as the next major source of energy to drive a world economy that goes into a leap back towards development and progress. These are the big ideas that have been put on the table by this organization, by Mr. LaRouche, and there are developments going on that not only avoid war, but open up the potential for a durable war prevention through these major technological leaps.
Well, this could include the Strategic Defense of Earth proposal that came out of Russia, a couple of years ago.
That's one thing, and you've got Xi Jinping attending the Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting that's going on in Kyrgyzstan right now, and coming in with a very detailed proposal to activate something that was first promoted by Helga and Lyndon LaRouche back in the early 1990s, namely the Eurasian land bridge. They're using that exact formulation, Eurasian land bridge, New Silk Road, high-speed rail corridors, development corridors of real agro-industrial development, powered by nuclear power and eventually by thermonuclear fusion. That's the agenda. And that agenda reverses two significant trends beyond even what we began to see as the disintegration of the United States starting in January 2001. You had the trend line since the assassination of John Kennedy, which has been a persistent downward collapse into the green post-industrial world. And even earlier, with the death of Franklin Roosevelt, the opportunity to deliver a final death blow to the system of European imperialism and colonialism, typified by the Anglo-Dutch power structure that runs world finance today. We lost that opportunity with Roosevelt's death. We had a sort of a second breather with Eisenhower with a lot of complications and counter pushes. And then you had Kennedy, and once Kennedy was assassinated, the intent to revive the FDR policy was killed along with him. And we've been downhill sliding ever since. And then we really hit a steep crash in January 01 that's carried through Obama. So we've got a lot of catching up and rebuilding to do. We've got damaged generations, particularly of young people, who have no skill sets to play a productive role in a growing economy. So the challenges are enormous, but these are at least the right kinds of challenges to be facing.
Well, Jeff, I want to come back to the broader strategic war question in a moment, but what you're bringing in now actually raises an immediate question, which is that prior to the threats of a strike against Syria and prior to the last recess of Congress for August, there was some growing momentum for Glass-Steagall. And now we've seen Elizabeth Warren on a number of occasions promoting this, conferences in Washington, discussions, an endorsement of Glass-Steagall at the recently concluded AFL-CIO convention. What's your sense of the potential now to break out of the controlled and phony debate over the budget deficit and get to the real issue of the end of the speculative monetary policy of the last 40 years with Glass-Steagall?
Look, I think the momentum is clearly there. One negative proof of it is the absolute hysterical reaction from Wall Street and from the whole Anglo-Dutch apparatus. Since the spring of this year, we know that Jamie Dimon, and he's obviously just typical of the big six Wall Street, too big to fail banks, has been running around the country blackmailing governors and other elected officials to get them to back off from any support for Glass-Steagall. Clearly, they've come to the conclusion that all of the firewalls that they had set up to avoid Glass-Steagall, which would mean instant bankruptcy for them, which is exactly what's needed. All of the firewalls they carefully had erected were breaking down and were unreliable. And so in Congress, you've got Glass-Steagall bills in both houses. You have leading voices continuously promoting Glass-Steagall. Elizabeth Warren has been, you know, particularly on point in the Senate on this. You have now half of the state legislatures in the United States, including big states like California, New York, New Jersey, have got resolutions calling on their congressional delegations to vote for Glass-Steagall. There's something like 85 co-sponsors already in the House. And we're heading into a period where the whole structure of the global financial system, especially in the transatlantic region, is really at a breakpoint. People inside the financial establishment are shaking in their boots. They think that something big is likely to blow up in the coming weeks. A lot of things have simply been put on hold because of the fact that German elections take place a week from tomorrow. And so Merkel's backers have been doing everything possible to keep a certain kind of stability, prevent some major explosion from happening in some big European bank, maybe even Deutsche Bank, until after September 22nd. We're at the end of the fiscal year where it's truth or consequences moment. Remember, it was this same time frame in 1998 when you had a near blowout of the whole financial system as the result of one bet gone wrong in one relatively medium-sized hedge fund, LTCM. In 2008, it was September when things blew apart, and the year earlier, it was August, September, when the bottom fell out of the real estate bubble, which was a key anchor of the entire financial gambling bubble that had built up since the repeal of Glass-Steagall. So it's all ready to blow. And the danger in the situation is that if the blowout occurs before we get Glass-Steagall in place, you could get pandemonium and a real further crisis. But right now, I think that the momentum coming out of this Kerry-Lavrov agreement and the pushback against war gives us a further moment of opportunity to drive Glass-Steagall home. Congress for the last 2 weeks was completely obsessed with the whole drama around Syria. And so now, at least for some period of time, barring some wild move by the Brits or the Saudis or whoever, we can concentrate on the Glass-Steagall issue.
It's Jeff, there are 2 points I want to ask you about on this. The first one is, you know, we've seen a couple of times in the last few years where there's been a mobilization of the population that had an impact on Congress. The first one, I think, in the recent period was the reaction against the bailout 5 years ago, where Congress was just swamped with calls from constituents against the bailout. And after a little bit of time passed, well, they went ahead and voted up the bailout anyway. Secondly, the next summer, after Obama had come in and was pushing the Obamacare, there was another explosion in the population. But that didn't last long, and they were able to grind down the opposition and push that through. Now we're seeing the population again as a factor in the political decision-making process of the Congress. This would obviously have an effect if it were to carry over into the economic side on Glass-Steagall. What would you say to the people listening that they need to know to what to do to make sure that this time we don't have another dissipation, but actually sustain the momentum?
Well, I think one absolutely crucial thing is that people have to get an idea of what this fight is all about. Glass-Steagall is a way of setting the stage for a revival of a credit system and a leap into the future. If it's only about stopping another bailout or something that's narrowly focused on some practical issue, then the impetus is not going to be there for a sustained fight on behalf of the leading elements in the population. What we are doing now, and people should really pay close attention to the LaRouche PAC website, where the 56-page pamphlet on thermonuclear NUWAPA is available and where there is a continuing stream of video reports on this issue. We've got to give people a sense of optimism of the future, not cockeyed optimism based on some kind of utopian fantasy, but on the basis of a real and viable plan for the future that gives people the ability to look at their children and grandchildren and say, I am going to leave you a better world than I inherited. That's always been the American vision. It's what makes the United States unique. We embody something that's a universal principle for all mankind. But the American Revolution was the highest accomplishment towards actually being able to do that. So what we've presented with this thermonuclear NUWAPA and what Glass-Steagall represents as a means to bankrupt the oligarchy and return to a Hamiltonian credit system. This is the basis on which people can get really excited and inspired, and on that basis, fight for the future. Because, as I said, since the Kennedy assassination, there has been an erosion of the underlying optimism that always informed the best periods in American and world history. When people had an idea that they were fighting for something in the future that was not just some Pollyanna dream, but was a vision that was clearly laid out. The NWAPA 21, the realization of thermonuclear fusion, the Bering Straits Project as an extension of the North American Water and Power Alliance program to completely transform the physical geometry of the Western Hemisphere, to then move through the Bering Straits into what Xi Jinping and others have been proposing in terms of the overall Eurasian land bridge, Kraa Canal Project, all of these things. This is the future. It'll take two generations to fully realize this vision, and then we'll be on to something else. You mentioned earlier the strategic defense of the Earth. Once we get the breakthrough on fusion, we can look in terms of the kind of programs that, for example, would give us the ability to put sensors and other capabilities on the surface of Mars to protect us against the danger of asteroids which are flying around the solar system, and one large asteroid striking planet Earth could wipe out mankind. We have the capability of very rapidly developing the defenses against that danger, which means first having sensors in deep space to be able to detect these asteroids and comets as they're moving at great speed through the solar system, and then developing the energy intensity systems required to either smash them up or tilt them off course. Mankind's survival in the coming centuries is going to depend on this kind of extraterrestrial mission.
And this has already been proposed to the United States by the Russians with their proposal of the strategic defense of Earth.
Right, and the Chinese recently signed a number of deals to work closely with the Europeans on moving to finally achieve the breakthrough on fusion.
So does this development then with the Kerry, Lavrov, Obama, Putin, this does point toward that kind of potential collaboration with Russia?
Oh, it absolutely does. It's a major step already in that direction. And we've got to just, you know, go forward from there.
Well, Jeff, the second question I wanted to ask on this basic topic is, to what extent is there a recognition among key people in Congress of the interrelationship between the financial collapse and the war danger? I mean, on the one side, you have many of the Democrats who are running around saying the deficit's coming down a little bit, we're having a slow but steady recovery, a complete delusional bunch of lies. But on the other side, you have the Republicans who are still stuck in this austerity is the only solution. And, you know, there's got to be some breakthrough on that. Do you see something moving on that as well in the Congress?
Well, I think what we're seeing right now is the beginnings of a profound realignment. Again, go back to the scandals that began coming out in the spring, and then the alliances that formed against the NSA scandal, the alliances that formed against the Syria war, the fact that you've got bipartisanship on support for Glass-Steagall. Part of this whole destructive dynamic that certainly predates January 2001, but really got horrific after that, is that we were drifting towards a parliamentary system where party loyalty trumped responsibility to govern for the country as a whole. Now you're getting the breakup of that vice grip. mm-hmm. you know, just illustrated by the fact that Boehner and Cantor thought that they could whip the Republican members of the House into voting for Obama's war, and they'd use that as trading points on negotiating on the budget. Pure insanity, but that's the kind of insanity that prevailed up until very recently. So you're getting a kind of process underway now of a realignment. More than half of the electorate, and certainly more than half of the likely voters among the electorate, are disgusted with both parties, have no party affiliation. So this realignment process is underway. The American people are way ahead of Congress on this.
Mm-hmm.
As you pointed out, they were adamantly opposed to the bailout back in 2008. They didn't know what the solution was. But when we presented the solution, first in the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act and then in the whole push to reinstate Glass-Steagall, people were able to understand that and say, yeah, we were looking for an alternative to the madness that's no longer tolerable to us.
Yeah, I think this stalemate between the two parties and replaying the same tired arguments over and over again is really starting to force the population again to look for alternatives outside of that. Now, I want to come back to something you just mentioned, the NSA scandal. I mean, there was one part of it which has got one day's headlines and then sort of disappeared, but I think is actually quite significant, which is the NSA-Israeli collaboration, where it, if what I read was accurate, there's raw data just being transferred to the Israelis of the tapping into the U.S. phone and internet system. Is that basically accurate?
Well, it's accurate, and it doesn't even tell the whole story. There are Israeli companies that have been contracted to carry out some of the critical programs for the NSA, for the Justice Department. There are two Israeli companies that are deeply involved in conducting, physically carrying out, all of the court-administered and court-authorized wiretaps for the FBI. So, you know, if anything, it's ironic that anyone should be surprised that we're sharing this stuff with the Israelis when, you know, in effect, they are so deeply embedded in the NSA structures that for all intents and purposes, they fall under the rubric of the U.S. intelligence community.
So they're basically co-partners in it.
Right. And many other governments, for whatever reasons, allowed themselves to be basically bamboozled into participating in this process. Again, go back to January 2001. 9 months before the September 11th attacks, Lyndon LaRouche delivered testimony opposing John Ashcroft's confirmation as Attorney General. The testimony really had very little to do with John Ashcroft per se. What LaRouche said was the character of this administration, the cabinet that's coming together, the character of Bush and Cheney is such that they will go for dictatorship. They will look to create a Reichstag fire type incident that can be used as the basis for imposing the kind of dictatorship the American people would never accept under normal conditions. 9 months later, we got the 9/11 attacks, and we know that that was a Anglo-Saudi operation. But it was conducted on behalf of those in the United States who wanted dictatorship, who wanted a Carl Schmitt unitary executive policy to be implemented, ripping up the U.S. Constitution.
Well, isn't everything that we've been hearing from the Snowden exposés and then the follow-ups in the media, isn't it just making it clear that, in fact, this has gotten worse? It didn't get better under Obama?
Yeah, precisely. I mean, all of the programs that have been revealed got their start, by and large, after 9/11. And so Obama comes into office. He's a very different proposition than people thought. Many, many people with decades of political experience have said to me personally, how could I have been so foolish and naive to buy into this guy's story? So things have gotten more extreme under Obama than they were under Bush and Cheney. For example, you know, you've got legitimate whistleblowers from within the intelligence community who are supposed to be protected by whistleblower statutes, who have been prosecuted under Obama, under the espionage laws, which has nothing to do with leaking evidence of criminal conduct by government agencies to legitimate news organizations. So that's something that Bush and Cheney contemplated, but decided against because there was still enough pushback on behalf of certain constitutional protections. But that's all gone out the window now.
Well, on that then, you know, one of the issues that comes up is whether Obama can be trusted to follow through with the agreement that was just made with the Russians, or whether there's some other agenda being played out here. And I know during the week, Lyndon LaRouche had some comments about Obama pretty much dooming himself. But you do have both the NSA scandal, and also there's still a lot to come out on Benghazi and then the broader question there, the role of the Saudis. So what do you think is the possibility for the removal of Obama in the period ahead?
Well, quite clearly, Obama saw the danger of his removal, and that's why he blinked and decided, number one, he had to go to Congress, and number two, when he realized he didn't have the votes, he accepted the life raft that was offered by Putin. So I think that it depends. We're at a shifting moment in this whole process. You know, Mr. LaRouche has always said the guy has already committed a raft of impeachable crimes. And at the same time, if he can be brought under control and can be basically a hostage to the larger institution of the presidency, then we may be able to live with that. We don't know. Things are moving very, very rapidly. And already, with this agreement signed between Lavrov and Kerry, there's already a dramatic shift. Obama is going down. And the question is, will he be smart enough to basically allow himself, for the sake of surviving in office, to be an instrumentality of a presidency that's committed to a change in policy? If that happens, then he better watch out for some of the very people who put him in office in London, on Wall Street, in places like that. They may go after him, you know, with a vengeance if he's no longer the useful instrument that they put him in there to be. So, as I say, there's a lot of unpredictables in the situation. For the moment, through this whole process that we've, I think, discussed pretty thoroughly here over the last 45 minutes or so, Obama is boxed in. He's agreed to something that greatly reduces the danger of thermonuclear war, that offers an opportunity not only to avoid conflict in Syria, but may open the door for getting a resolution on the Iran situation as well. So if we eliminate some of the hot-button situations that have been used by the oligarchy to push war when it was to their advantage, then we've just got to keep pushing ahead. And as I say, we've got to give people a leap into the future, a vision for what can be accomplished. And as always, the starting point is Glass-Steagall. Right now, we're going into next week when the Federal Open Market Committee has its meeting next Tuesday, Wednesday, and where there's at least a report from Nikkei News Service that Obama is going to name Larry Summers as the new chairman of the Fed.
You see that with the Congress now having a sense that they can back down the president, as we saw in this whole battle around the Syria strike. This may be the kind of thing that puts a nail in his coffin, because there are so many Democrats who want to change the policy. They don't want to continue to go along with austerity and cutbacks, and they're getting a little nervous about Obamacare. I think the appointment of Summers could push this process again further ahead.
That's exactly right. And the question, of course, now is, Obama blinked twice on Syria in the face of massive public opposition, massive congressional opposition, with a Congress that's no longer sucking their thumb. Is the opposition coming, especially from Democrats on the Senate Banking Committee, to Larry Summers going to be sufficient to convince Obama to go a different way? If he goes a different way, then what's he going to do when Glass-Steagall is put on his desk, having passed the House and the Senate with a substantial bipartisan majority? That is a crucial thing that we've got to accomplish.
I think that can't be emphasized too much, that Glass-Steagall essentially is the entry point to this whole new future, because with the current banking system, not just the fact that it's fragile and could blow at any point, but the fact that you can't get credit for anything. You can't even get credit to open up a mom-and-pop store, much less develop a thermonuclear nuapa. So the Glass-Steagall fight, and this is something which Lynn has emphasized for a long time, is not an also-ran. It's a crucial part of reaching this future vision.
That's exactly right.
Well, now, Jeff, we have a little less than 10 minutes to go, and I just want to recap a couple of things here to... I did want to bring up, ask you for your assessment of where the potential hearings that are being demanded by Representative Wolf and others into the Benghazi investigation, and then also the renewed momentum from former Senator Graham, the Sarasota newspapers, and elsewhere on the question of the Saudi role in 9/11. Is there a possibility that something will break from that?
It's getting more and more likely. And in fact, since we've identified this strategic turn as of this morning with the signing of this U.S.-Russian agreement on the Syria chemical weapons, very clearly there are some powerful political forces that are going to try to sabotage this by any means necessary. And therefore, keeping the spotlight, keeping a pin-down operation on this Anglo-Saudi apparatus is now more important than ever. And I think, number one, on Friday, yesterday, Senator Ted Cruz introduced a parallel bill in the Senate to the Frank Wolf bill in the House, calling for the establishment of a joint select committee to investigate Benghazi, like the Graham committee, the joint committee that looked into the original 9/11 attacks. There's 22 co-sponsors in the Senate now, and it's up to 173 co-sponsors in the House. So this has enormous traction, and this clearly is a sword of Damocles hanging over Obama's head. Secondly, there is a growing interest and momentum within the Congress to get those 28 pages declassified. Congressman Walter Jones issued a press release on Wednesday basically demanding that the 28 pages be declassified. And what he revealed in the press release is that he had an opportunity to actually go into a secured area and review those 28 pages. And obviously, the material contained in them is a real blockbuster. And what he said is that powerful political forces want to bury this for clear and obvious reasons, but there is nothing in those 28 pages that reveals methods or procedures or anything else to justify the classification as top secret and keeping it hidden from the American people.
There's no national security threat to release those 28 pages.
Not in the least, especially now 12 years after the fact. But, of course, we know that within those 28 pages is a laser focus on Prince Bandar, who is the current head of the Saudi National Security Council, head of Saudi intelligence, the GID, and the main source of funding for the jihadists in Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, throughout that whole area.
And the work that you've done over the years to expose Bandar, which people tried to dismiss as a marginal issue or the wing nuts of the conspirophiles, it's now out everywhere. It was in the Wall Street Journal. It's generally become a known factor.
Exactly.
Well, Jeff, let me ask you one other question, because this is something that has come up in some people I've been talking to, the anger at Putin for the audacity of writing this op-ed in the New York Times that people characterize as lecturing the United States. Now, clearly, this is some of the people who have been knocked on their rear ends by the changes that we've been discussing this hour. But what do you make of the of what Putin is doing? This does represent a different quality of an intelligence operative than we're used to seeing from the U.S. side.
Well, I think that you've got forces moving in the United States and Russia in concert. You mentioned earlier the pivotal role of General Martin Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and really the whole leadership of our military that has been adamantly opposed to this Syria war. General Dempsey has emphasized that he considers the relationship with Russia and China to be of paramount importance. He said that with respect to China, he rejects the idea of the what he calls the Thucydides trap. Thucydides was the great historian of the Peloponnesian Wars, and basically the trap is that war is an inevitable thing between a rising power, i.e. China, and a static or declining power, i.e. the United States. So the military here in Russia and China have a strong vested interest in building up channels of cooperation and avoiding war. So there's a foundation for a transformation of the relationship between the U.S., Russia, China. You can throw India into that equation because of its size. Many other countries, Japan, South Korea. What we need is a resurgence of cooperation among perfectly sovereign nation states, which was the core concept of John Quincy Adams, who really was the father of American foreign policy and diplomacy.
And that's the real American exceptionalism.
Correct, exactly.
I think what Putin attacked as American exceptionalism is the Obama doctrine of the responsibility to protect.
And also the idea that the United States is the next empire to come along. But what you've got here is a commitment to avoid war, because war under present circumstances is insane, because it very rapidly becomes a war of extinction if you get the United States, Russia, China involved in it, because you've got submarine launch missile capabilities with thermonuclear warheads that can wipe out life on this planet many times over, and you've got a hair trigger situation once you get into a cycle of military escalation. In the case of Syria, the reason that there's been such strong opposition on the part of the military and intelligence establishment here, same in Russia, with obviously Putin being the personification of that apparatus, they know that a war gets easily out of control, and there are areas of mutual cooperation that need to be explored but can't be explored as long as people like Susan Rice, Samantha Power, others are running around trying to demonize Russia, demonize Putin, and make sure that the existing structure of Anglo-Dutch empire power over the globe is preserved. You know,
Jeff, we're going to have to stop at this because we've reached the end of our time.
Okay.
But I think you've given people a lot to think about. I assume this will be the leading story in the upcoming EIR.
For sure.
All right, so people should go to the LaRouche Pub website, get an EIR subscription if you don't have one, EIR online. And Jeff, thanks for joining us. And
pleasure,
we'll be back
really.
Next Saturday, 3 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of the LaRouche Show.
Great.